a good question. There's actually a couple different ways to do it, but the primary way they do it. Have you ever seen a Sony Trinitron and looked at the way it lights up? Nick?
I sure have. A whole bunch of horizontal stripes in the original Sony Trinitron tube. And so the mask in that case is not a bunch of holes in a triangular pattern. It's a bunch of horizontal wires, so to speak. Go ahead.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Actually, it's a bunch of horizontal stripes of plastic.
There is a mask behind it, which is a bunch of wires that make slots. And if you look carefully at the Trinitron, you'll actually see four black lines in the picture, across the picture. If you look really carefully and take a magnifying glass, those are the wires that prevent that string of metal stripes from vibrating.
If you whack on the tube, you'll see they're actually vibrating a little bit.
But there's four very ultra-thin wires. When you step back from the TV, you don't see the black that it makes, but the boxer doesn't light up under those black wires, so they're horizontally across the screen. But anyway, the point of the matter is if you put a red, green, and blue stripe next to each other, and you make them very small, since the liquid crystal basically attenuates light and passes light, you can make color.
So it's color stripes of transparency film, so to speak, that I think is really doing it. Fred, I think you had a question or a comment. Go ahead, Fred.
I found some files with codes for remotes, for different brands of remotes, referencing the Channel Master remote that I have here for HH2. So it's getting late. I'm going to say 73, and I'm QR to Peoria.
Okay, Fred. You brought us a darn interesting question. You stumped us to some degree. And as you solve this problem, please come back and let us know. So, Eric, was I correct in assuming now you've got red, green, and blue Raman filter stripes in between the source of illumination and the individual pixels? So you could say there's a whole arrays of this whole horizontal stripes of pixels that are dedicated to those three primary colors. And yes, I've seen those three or four vertical wires on the Sony Trinitron too, and they are quite subtle if you don't know where to look for them. Thank you, Eric.
Yeah, actually, they're quite clever the way they keep that mask together.
Well, you know, the simplest way I can tell you is if you have a liquid crystal display that's colored and it's in front of you, get yourself a really good magnifier and you'll see what I'm talking about.
There's red, green, and blue stripes. Actually, most of the cameras, the digital cameras that you use, they don't have three chips in them, three CCDs or three. They have one carefully layered on top of that CMOS sensor, a stripe. Now, interestingly enough, how do we separate the red, green, and blue colors from it? Well, as you could probably guess, because each stripe, red, has a particular bandwidth, and green has another particular bandwidth, and blue has another particular bandwidth. I don't remember exactly what the frequencies are. But when you look at the waveforms that it makes, you know, you can separate the red, green, and blue by knowing what the bandpass of each component is.
Okay, so I think you're saying that back in the days when the phosphors had particular intensities for a given number of milliamperes of beam current hitting them, I think you're telling me the red, green, and blue signal that came out of the matrix in the television receiver was designed to accommodate, and I'll bet you even at the transmitting site, the television transmitter was designed in such a way to emphasize the fact that red, for instance, needed a hell of a lot more current in the old days. And I'll bet you that changed some of the standards that used to be used. Am I even close here, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, that's a nice thought. But what I'm talking about is having red, green, and blue filters, okay? And each one of them will create an AC signal that is a certain frequency component. And by simply filtering them, you can separate the red, green, and blue components. What we do in transmission is a sort of like analog compression to reduce, using the frequency responses of the three colors is what actually came, how we came up with the formula of how we transmit color, which is a form of analog compression, not visual compression. And essentially, since the eye doesn't need to see too much blue, that's why there's only 11%, and it really needs to see green, which is 50%, it doesn't need as much red, what we do is we subtract them from the total signal. That's how we come up with, you know, Y minus this black and white, and B minus the black and white. And one's at 0 degrees, and one's at 90 degrees, and why the signal only needs to be 1.2 megs, it's that much. Yeah, we're really fooling the eye. For instance, certain colors are a mixture of red, green, and blue. I could create, red and blue gives me a sort of a magenta. I could produce the exact wavelength that makes the eye think it saw orange. I can take just the right ratio of red and green, and the eye will think it saw orange. Well, you've really got red, green, and blue cones inside of the eye. There's all kinds of foolery going on here. Thank you, Eric. Yeah, that's very true. Actually, there was a camera that was made that used purple and green. So you only need two, not three. But anyway, getting back to the single sensors and the liquid crystal, if you use a magnifying glass on your liquid crystal display, you'll see the stripes. Because the pixels only attenuate light, you know, it's not like we can change the color of the liquid. I just happen to own a stereo zoom Bausch & Lomb microscope with a pair of fiber optic illuminators. And the next time I've got a liquid crystal display in my hand, I'm going to put it under that microscope and start looking at it. I'm a little bit sorry I haven't done that a hell of a lot earlier. I did it with my wristwatch one day, my liquid crystal display wristwatch. And I said, wow, life at the miniature level is very different. If you've ever done any work with 0402 surface mount components, you'll rapidly realize that the microscopic world is very different. You take a small little probe and you try to push the resistor into the right position before you solder it down. And you think you're going to nudge it a couple thousandths of an inch. And it jumps half a mile and you'll never see it again. It's just been tiddlywinked. I bet you've been through that scene. Well, you don't use the microscope. I don't know how you get away with it, Eric. Go ahead. Oh, well, you know, I don't give myself ice cream. I need the microscope, but not yet. I don't know. I just haven't found one on eBay that I don't feel like spending as much as they're asking for some of these people. But, considering what it cost originally, you gotta make a choice at some point. But I have these magnifiers that I wear, and they're pretty good. So that's what the glass is. I have an S7 that I'm putting on it. When I'm working on, like, you know, 0205, 0206, those things are so thick and tiny. It's unbelievable. Oh, the one thing that I didn't mention about the liquid crystals is that you can think of each pixel as three sub-pixels, okay? That's how they do the selection of color. That isn't just a physical location. It's really, you can consider each pixel to be a red, a green, and a blue stripe, kind of like Pinson. So there's really a cell behind each one, because
I think what they normally do is call it subpixels, but it takes 3 subpixels to make a whole pixel, which is, you know, part of the matrix. Because the stripes that are giving the raw color from the illuminator to the liquid crystal screen are horizontal stripes, are the individual pixels then also made slightly oblong horizontal, or are they circular objects?
First of all, the stripes aren't horizontal, they're vertical, just like in a transom. The scan lines happen to be horizontal, so you break up the pixel horizontally. But the stripes, you know, one pixel, if you make white with one pixel, you'll see a red, a green, and a blue stripe.
Okay, but each individual portion of what I call the liquid crystal pixel, let's assume I choose the one that's red, and I look at it under high magnification, is the shape of the material in there that's going to go from polarization A to polarization B, is that little particular piece of material that I can address, is it oblong in shape or is it circular in shape?
There's nothing circular in any of these displays. So let's get past that. So if you were to take a pencil and you were to draw a box, and let's call that box a pixel. Inside that box, you take a red pencil and draw one red vertical line. And right next to it, you draw one green vertical line. And to the right of it, you draw one blue vertical line. And they all fit perfectly into that box. That's one pixel. Okay, and you can actually address that red line, that green line, or that blue line. And that's how you make color.
Okay, I think I see that. What's the approximate horizontal to vertical ratio of, let's say, the red addressable portion of that pixel?
Pixels tend not to be square, right? If everything was square, we would be talking computers like 512 by 512 or 1024 by 1024. So, as you can guess, you know, a typical CCA resolution is, 1125 by, I don't know, I can give you an example. A resolution of, 640 by 480, nobody uses it, because that's a television resolution. You know, I think it's a 1120 by 9 something. That's not very square, so, you know, divide that up by however many pixels it is, and then fill the lines, you're really looking at rectangles.
I can see that. And my last question is a guess on your part as to what is the approximate fill factor. If I look with my microscope at individual pixels, are the active regions 90% and is the 10% dead space around them where no light gets through of the right color? But what's the approximate fill factor of the active pixels if I had red, green, and blue together? Eric, go ahead.
Oh, I'd say it's somewhere in the 80%. I mean, there's very little space between them. They kind of butt up against each other. But yeah, there's a gap, so maybe it's somewhere between 80 and 90%.
Okay, I thank you an awful lot. I'm a lot smarter on the display devices. I've only got 50 more questions, but I think Mel better get over to his mailbag or we're going to get the flack. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Now, Roger, this is K2KEY, yeah. Very interesting about liquid crystal, you know, there's a lot more to it. The bottom line is, in other words, if you've got a TV set purchased in the last couple of years, it most likely is worth buying one of those boxes converted so that you'll be ready for next February and keep that TV if it has an excellent picture, because you've got one TV here, but really you seldom use it, but it sits here in the kitchen, 15-inch TV that's such a beautiful sharp picture, and I just
take something, so I think it would be reasonable to get a box for it so I can see this. Basically two things on it. The news in the morning and the news at night that take over.
Well, did you ask for your coupon, so you only have to spend like $40?
That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to get a coupon and get myself a box. And because the picture is excellent, so from what you're telling me now about all these displays, they got a lot to go. Am I correct, Eric?
Yeah, well, let's put it this way. If you're just going to watch you know, regular old TV, and if you've got a 4x3 set that makes a decent picture, you ain't never seen the good pictures it can make until you get the box. So, I mean, you know, have the box anyway. It just makes your TV viewing a lot more pleasurable.
Yeah, most of it's not really so much viewing as it is listening, you know. I got to get most likely usually certain things like the weather report or whatever. A couple other odds and ends to see what murder or mayhem is going on. Not much of a TV watching, so basically it's wasted on me, but I guess I'll need it, so be something. So I guess that's the cheap way out, I assume, Eric Oliver.
Yeah, well, it'll be like watching a new TV if you do watch anything. Anyway, you know, make sure you get your coupon and go buy a box. You'd be quite surprised. On to the mailbag. K2KEY, KEY2.
Yeah, one quick question, Eric. When you tell him to buy a box, are you telling him to buy a converter box for his older set or to buy something that's really capable of a 16x9 reasonably high resolution display? Which kind of box are you talking about?
Okay, I'm assuming he has a TV set that's going to go blank, so that's the first thing. I mean, if you don't watch television, why go out and buy another TV set? You've got a perfectly good TV set.
Understand. But once he's got high-def capability, even on a small screen, and digital reception capability, he's one of the guys like me. I'm the only guy in my town I know of that does not have cable TV. You think I'm a real dinosaur? I realize my satellite system and whatever. Now, that combined, once he's got digital TV and he can start watching you know, some real good PBS programming like Nature and Nova and Carrier and Science Channel and NASA Select, he doesn't have to watch the soap operas. He doesn't have to watch only the news. Occasionally, there's some darn good educational programming. But we ought to let you go to the mailbag. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yeah, well, just let me stop you for a second. And if you had a digital box, which you should have, Dick, there's actually a program called World and Create, and there's an awful lot of good stuff on it, but you can't see it unless you go get a box.
You're going to hear something that's going to really floor you. I own a box. Somebody gave me one, a converter box. I've got to fix my UHF antenna on the tower. I've got one of the best tower locations in the world and don't have a UHF antenna on it that's operational. Ain't that sad?
Well, then you're the pair of rabbit ears.
I hear you. And at my location, 300 feet above sea level, in theory it should work. K2KEY, you got it, Mel.
K2KEY, really fine business there on everything. Yeah, I'm sure there's something to find on some specialized programming channels. The point is, I don't really have the patience or the time because I have other things really that are more important to me. And I, you know, between the computer and other things that I'm involved with, I just don't really sit down and really watch any program in entirety, unless there's something very special. All right, with that, let's try a couple of these things here. Here's one test. Oh, yes. Now I took your advice and I added radios by that method of sewing it underneath the lawn. My wife was amazed how I put the radios under the lawn, and this would serve any part of the lawn. Excellent idea with that big needle thing for sewing the radios under the lawn. The only question I ask now, the 40-meter vertical that I have works working excellent. Can I also use this same set of radios, buried radios, for 20-meter vertical? In other words, do I have to add more radios? In other words, you want to use the already existing radios that get put down, 20 of them, if I can also use them for 20-meter, 40-meter radio to take over.
I'm going to give you my answer, and you're going to give us your slant. Because you've done it, and I'm going to use what I think is the right theory, and you might have to correct me. If I lay down 40-meter ground plane radials, each of those radials are in the vicinity of 65 feet long. Because we usually set radials to be a quarter wavelength space, quarter wavelength in length, and if the whole ground plane antenna and the radials were up in the air at some altitude, that's exactly the right thing to do. You'd like them to be quarter wavelength long. When I take my whole vertical ground plane antenna and bring it down to Mother Earth, that Earth is such a heavy resistive loading object. It's a distributed resistor. Lossy is all hell. Therefore, you carefully cut each one of those radials to be 63 feet, 4.5 inches, plus another 16th of an inch. I know what some hams will do. And they think they're resonating each radial. And if they knew how much resistive loading that Earth is giving them and how DQ'd it is, there ain't no resonance there. That ground plane radio would work anywhere from 40 to 140 feet long. It wouldn't make much difference when you're on 40 meters. When you go to 100, when you go to 60, 20 meters, twice the frequency, the fact that the radio is too long doesn't matter. It is so far out of resonance because of the resistive loading. See, what people fear is that if the ground plane radios were a halfway long, you have an open circuit at the far end, and therefore they would reflect a near open circuit at the near end. Up in the air, half wavelength long radios would not work very well. Smack down on Mother Earth, I think they're going to work like a charm. I bet you've done some experiments along these lines, Mel. Maybe you've got real hard data. K2KEY, K2LIW.
The rule of thumb I always thought with radios, buried radios, is the more the merrier. In other words, put down as much as you, many as you can within reason. I have 100 buried, and I find it works excellent field for my vertical. The point is that they do not have to be, and they're not, you know, in many cases, capable of putting them down a nice deep symmetry, you know, fanning them out like they show you classically in the magazine, a book, but extend them, you can fit them at all. I feel as long as you can get enough of that copper and screening down, that it will work, and like you say, especially the radios, I have, you have laid radios for 40 meters, about 33 feet, quarter wave, about 33 feet each or so. You most likely will have very good results with them on 20 meters, because they will wind up basically about a full wavelength. Full wavelength of the radios on 20 meters, Dick, because I believe the reciprocal between doubling the frequency going from 7 to 14 megahertz, the harmonic relationship, I would say, carries over to the radio too, if I'm not mistaken, over.
Yeah, I think we're onto something here. First of all, I made a math error. Yes, a 40-meter antenna, if it was a dipole, is something like 66 feet long. But the radiator for 40 meters is more like 31, 32 feet long, and the radial should be something like 31 or 32 feet long, each individual radiator, to make them quarter wavelength. My impression, though, if the radiators are laying on the ground or below the ground, the more the better, the longer the better. You're trying to make your backyard look like a solid sheet of copper. In the ideal world, you lay down enough radials, and there's a long enough length of them that the space between the radials, particularly in close to the base of the radiator, you want the space between the radials, the ground plane radials, to be such a small fraction of the wavelength so that RF wave can't squeeze in there and can't see the dirt. So, 40-meter radials on the Earth, I think, are going to work better on 20 meters, slightly better, than the exact same number of pure 20-meter radials. Yes, the 40-meter radials, 32 feet long, are going to be a quarter wavelength long at 40 meters. They're going to be a half wavelength long on 20 meters, which, if they were up in the air, is not so good. Down on the ground, I think they're going to work like a charm. What do you think, Mel?
Basically, that's what I was saying, that the ones that were buried, if you get enough of them down, they will work quite well with a quarter-wave radiator above them. As long as the radiator above it is either the radials are cut to that particular band, or the band that you're going to use, such as 20 meters, that it'll be more than substantial for 20 meters because of their length is much longer than is necessary for 20 meters. But like you say, the more the merrier and the longer the merrier. So I think you should have some good results with a 20-meter vertical over a 40-meter radial bed. I think that would be the bottom line thing over.
I'm fairly sure that's the conclusion you and I are coming to, Mel. Trying to make your backyard look like copper. Don't worry about the radials being too long. Worry about them being too short for the lowest band you're going to use. You're going to be hurting there. Because if I had 20-meter ham radio band radials, which I guess are around 16 feet long, and I use that antenna with a 40-meter radiator, now the 40-meter wavelength is going to overflow your only 16-foot-long radials. You get the math right now. I think that's true. And therefore, it's going to see some of the dirt out at the perimeter, and you're going to get a little loss in efficiency. On top of that, if you've got a good enough antenna tuner and a low enough loss in the feed line, to some degree, you don't have to worry about taking the 40-meter ground plane antenna system and using it on 20 meters, using it on 15 meters, using it on 10 meters. Percentage-wise, you're going to radiate a lot of that high percentage of that RF into space. The only thing a little bit complicated about this now is that because you've got multiple quarter waves of radiator, the elevation pattern gets a little bit more complicated. There could be some real advantages in that. Have you seen people taking a 80 or 40-meter ground plane antenna system? Don't even retune it. Don't worry about the fact that it's got a 30-to-1 standing wave ratio on some other higher band. As long as the feed line is low enough and long, and your antenna tuner has enough range, I think it can work quite well. I wonder if any of your guys have tried that. No. A2KEY, A2LIW.
I was questioned about this, Dick. This is K2KY one time because I had a visitor that took a look and he said, what is that coil that you have at the bottom of your vertical? I put a coil, an inductor, in the bottom. That's actually my tuning network for the vertical. Even though the vertical is basically a quarter wave on 80 meters, the reason I put that inductor down there so as to tune out any of the reactants that I ran into, but for another reason, I wanted the vertical to have a path directly to ground. Now, I think it's quieter. I think it doesn't build up as much of static charge on it by that method. So I have the tuning network for the vertical right at the base of the vertical. It's the inductor and a capacitor that's in a covered with basically, it was a plastic bottle that I cut the bottom out so that the top goes through, the wire goes through the top of it, and slip down over the assembly, so that's my waterproofing system. But I feel that I like to tune it, if possible, right at the source pick over.
That's always the best. Now your standing wave ratio on the transmission line is really low, and therefore the transmission line does not acquire any extra loss. But now here's the bottom line question, Mel. You just happen to own a damn good ground plane radio system. I think it's 100 radiators, radioles, buried under the black macadam asphalt or whatever, of the black town of your particular community, because you laid them down just before they did that renovation out in front of your house. So therefore, you have a substantial 80-meter ground plane antenna, vertical ground plane antenna. By way of your tuning mechanism at the base of that antenna, you can tune it on the higher bands than 80 meters. How many of those bands have you operated on? 40, 20, 15, 17, 10? How many of them have you operated on? And I know you've told me that it's quieter. Were you reasonably pleased on the way it got out on those other bands? Over to you, Mel.
Well, let me explain the whole situation here. I got interested in low band DX on 80 meters. I went for this thing, you know, I looked for challenges. Every fact, for instance, every time I got a new mobile unit, I started all over trying to work WAS, DXCC for the mobile. Give me something to do every day when I was traveling back and forth, especially some kind of goal, some kind of accomplishment, whatever. Then came the accomplishment. I wanted 5-band DXCC. And so what I did is put up an antenna, you know, to get the 5-band DXC on 20 meters and 15 and 10, and not much of a problem with the, you know, big tower in the backyard with big beams on it and all. That was workable. Came to 40 and 80 meters, a little bit of a different situation. So what I did is put this 80-meter vertical up, and it's just for 80 CW portion of the band. That's where I concentrated my efforts to get the DXCC for 80 meters. So I have not tried nor retuned or done anything in a way of changing that that antenna system there other than for 80. Let me let it drop. So, yes, what I could think. Now, this was planned in advance, but long before I had the vertical up, like Dick just mentioned, I was fortunate enough to see that far ahead that while the street sidewalks, everything's ripped out of here while they installed the new storm drainage system. It seems to be empty here, originally, the way the street was pitched and everything, the sewer system, everything here actually flowed down into the ocean here, right down in the corner, 350 feet from my south. Of course, that was that pollution situation had to be remedied, so they tore up everything and redirected all the sewer lines to go through a treatment plant. So, with everything out, and I mean they took everything out, the street out, the sidewalks out, everything, it gave me that golden opportunity just to literally just lay the radios out there with David's help. Just rake them out there and kick sand on to them, thump them down, and get my fingers crossed that when they came here to finish up the job, they didn't do any more digging. Now they just laid the street on, the new street on, and dig over.
Once again, Mel, that's a golden opportunity. I think you did say you laid down 100 radials. What gauge wire or what kind of wire did you use? Did you have any fear that the X number of years downrange, it might corrode if it wasn't heavy enough gauge or the right material? Back to you, Mel.
I should say, with hands for nothing, you know, who's going to complain? Say, you know, the wire I got was a piece of wire that the telephone company used for their trunk, one of the trunk lines that most might see it. You look at the end of it, and there's hundreds of wires in there. Inside this, you know, sheathing, I think it's number 22 wires individually here with a plastic coating. The originals would, I think, would have rotted away, the original stuff they used to use with silk coating. But top, you got nice plastic 22 covered wires. So I got a piece that was 65 feet long. They were nice enough to give me that would be tossed in the dumpster, literally. I took it in here in the driveway, stretched it out, took a knife, a carpet, old-fashioned carpet knife that had a good handle on it, and I split the sheathing open, pulled out lots of that wire. Oh, hundreds of those wires are in there. So I was able to lay down 65-foot length of 100-foot thick. They're number 22, I believe, solid over.
Okay, nice, solid, high-strength, drawn copper wire, which would possibly decode a road in some places, but they got this high-quality plastic coating on top of them, and you left on that plastic coating because it would be too much trouble to take it off, and you'd have more corrosion if you did. So you have 22-gauge insulated wire, 100 of them, all 65 feet long, all laid out in all directions you could make it. Wow. Out of curiosity, have you ever measured the resistance to earth on any one of those individual wires after this was all covered over? Go ahead.
Oh, I brought it together, and I have a ground screen on top of it. There's a piece that, as I said, we talk about valving and dumpster diving. Oh, boy, oh, boy. I went around every place I saw around here. They were changing windows, putting in the modern windows. And the old windows they pulled out had screens. Now, years ago, all the screening was copper. Oh, you look at all the old screening you had in your houses. Everybody had copper screening. Now they got plastic screening. So they were throwing them out. So I did this copper screening, out of the frame as I went by. But that's a, if there's no salvage on it, years ago, worthless stuff. If copper's gone sky high now, I don't think anybody would throw it away anymore. But I took those copper screening. I made myself a copper. I cleaned off the edges with acid. And soldered with the old-fashioned iron I have that you heat up on a stove, heat up with a burner. That's the plumber's iron. And went down the line and made myself a huge mat. I think the mat wound up at like 8 by 12. That went down there, too, and covered up the whole radio bed. So everything got bonded together in one big blob over.
Wow. Have you got ground? So 8 by 12 feet of copper screening, all edges soldered together, and I'm guessing there's a small hole in the center where it goes over your center insulator, and all of that lays on top of those 22-gauge, 100 ground plane radials. Is that true?
Oh, it's not right on the center, because, you see, you've got to look at how it's laid out there. It's part of the screen comes up to the foundation, up to the edge of the building. And the other part of the screen pulls out, so the vertical's not sitting dead center on it. It's sort of off to one corner of it. The trees were, there were a lot of things. I didn't have the classical ideal, layout that you would see in a magazine with everything fanned out nice and neat, like to show you. No, it's nowhere near that. It's more of a hodgepodge, the way everything came together. But it seems to work real well. In fact, last night. I've got to remember. I'm losing track of time. I got home. It was close to 2 o'clock in the morning. And I usually sit down just to unwind. Then my sleeping pills usually speed up. It makes me very relaxed when I fall asleep. And last night on ACW, I talked to CW. I worked with a guy in South Africa, another guy. I've worked them before, but they were calling CQ and nobody would come back for them. I worked with a guy in South Africa, another guy in the Indian Ocean. Weak signals way, way down there, but believe it or not, under this propagation and all, you still can work some great low-band DXing over.
How many watts were you using on 80 meters to do that, Mel?
Believe it or not, I usually only run 100 watts. I've got the amplifier, of course, but I see, first of all, that they got copy on me. I believe if they got copy on you, I don't worry about so much signal report. You get solid copy, yes or no. I don't care if it's 559, 569, 599. That's not the point. That whole system with the RFP is too overblown. I think, can you make the contact? That's the answer, over.
Okay. out of curiosity, you were running what code speed when you did that?
Comfortable about 20, 25. I can do 30. I can copy 30 words a minute without any problem. Even 35 sporadically, but I'm comfortable around 20, 25, which seems to be a great number of these stations. Some of the rare DX stations that are running pile-up will, you know, definitely hang it at least 35 words a minute. But, you know, all, you have, all you're getting from them is that's it, the 73. I mean, you know, it's nothing more than getting your call letters and hearing your call letters and hearing that 599, and that's it, Dick, over.
Okay, at that speed, like 25 words a minute, which you're comfortable with, my guess is because of your practice and your comfortableness with that, you're writing almost nothing down during the actual cue. So if the guy holds a rag chew with you, that it's almost all mental copy. Is that true?
Roger, you know, you get down to that point if you're getting into a rag chew, you're comfortable at 20, 25 words. And then, of course, you know, do most of it in your head. You make a little note here. Of course, note the name, note the UTH. Signal report, of course, you'll note, sometimes make a note to get into a little USO, what kind of rig you're running, antennas, weather conditions, how old you are, how many you're hamming, you know, what, you know, if you get into a deep rig, you make a note here and there, you know, but, yeah, most of it, you know, you get the gist of it in your head. You don't have to make detailed notes to take over.
Yeah, but what he's saying, you're copying mentally. You're only recording the amount of data you care about for permanent records, like call letters, time, signal report, QTH, and a few things. The stuff that you put in the log is the only thing you're writing down. And if I know you, you probably write it straight into the log. Don't even put it on a piece of scrap paper. Is that true?
I have what I use. And this is KQKDY. I have log, what is called logging left, I bought that many years ago. I have a dedicated computer that sits in a Radio Shack. And it's got the logging program, it's got a lot of ham facilities, different things like that, so, you know, antenna remodeling and all that good. So I have that keyboard sitting to my left and the key in front of me. So while I'm copying with my left hand, I'm able to punch in all that information. But it's great because the logging program has, like, for instance, as soon as you start the QSO, you push like F2 key. It puts in the time and date automatically. Then you punch in the call, and the call right below it is the signal report. Right below that is the name. Right below that next line is the QTH, and then the frequency, then the power, and all that mode, and all that stuff. Then there's a place that you can put in extra information. QSLing or whatever, you know. So you can do it easily with your left hand. You don't have to take a lot of notes to take over.
Okay, so you're running the key, and it's either a bug or a straight key with your right hand. You're running the computer and putting the data in with your left hand. You're typing with your left hand when it comes to typing information in. Reminds me of that old joke of people, if you get a guy with very sloppy code, you send him QLF, which I think means now send with your left foot. Go ahead.
Roger. No, I use that in Lyamic system, you know, the Kia. And, I'm not I never really got to the point where I really am satisfied with my sending. I'm decent, but I know some people have just that knack of sending that. Well, you know what it is? I found a number of people, and I questioned them, that I know that really are terrific CWs. I mean, they send the sounds just like playing music, and that was the secret. They were musically inclined, and you'd be amazed. Those people are extremely good at sending CW. Must have something to do with their way of able to carry a tune stick over.
Oh, yeah. There are some people who, by whatever means they learn the code, they've got relatively poor weighting factor between dots and dashes, and copy is kind of difficult. There are other people who send Morse code with such an art form that it sounds like a machine thing, has almost no personality. I'm sure you've noticed that a majority of your close friends do recognize their fist. The guy doesn't even have to send call letters. You hear him send about three words and say, oh yeah, I know him, that's Frank. I didn't know he was going to be down this low end of the band tonight. I've seen that, I've witnessed that. Fun type stuff. Hey, you better go on to at least one more mailbag, or we're gonna get a flack. K2KUY, K2RIW.
Roger, this is K2KUY. Okay, yeah, I've had a lot of them. You know, in the past, I try to fill it so we don't get buried with them here, but I try to save a few here that are interesting. Okay, a couple of weeks ago, you were discussing expressed things about antenna in degrees. What did you mean by antenna in degrees? How does that pair with length and all? Oh, all right, I see what he's getting at. In other words, the conversion, like, for instance, I would assume what he means that if we said, like, well, I mean, I guess, how do I explain it? Maybe you can explain that. You start out with a full wavelength that's 360 degrees. Then if you, divide it, say, by 4, it would be 90. So that would be 90 degrees. So that would be equivalent to like a quarter wavelength. Am I explaining it? We could go ahead.
You got it absolutely right. So full wavelength to an antenna maven is called a 360-degree long antenna. A half-wave antenna is a 180-degree antenna. The quarter-wave radiator of a quarter-wave ground plane, the radiator is 90 degrees long before you add electronic compensation. I'll explain that in a minute. Very few hands use degrees very often. Antenna engineers use it relatively frequently because the charts in the good book are sometimes written in degrees, not wavelengths. If you go to Chapter 3 of the original issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, the first edition, 1982, it's Chapter 3, and all other editions, and there are 4 editions of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, all other editions except the first, it's Chapter 4. When you go to Chapter 4, you will see a paragraph. At first you'll say, they're a little bit dense. One graph will tell you, this is the resistive component of the impedance of a ground plane monopole for various lengths of that monopole. And the lengths are expressed in degrees. And also on the chart, you'll see not one line where reactance or resistance is plotted vertically, and degrees, which is really length, is plotted horizontally. You'll see not one line, but you'll see 30 lines. And what's the difference between the lines? It's what is called A to D ratio. That really means diameter to length. If I use a piece of 30-gauge wire, I get a certain ratio of length to diameter. If I use a 10-gauge piece of wire, I get a smaller ratio of length to diameter. And the chart, in the case of the resistive component, let me drop, the chart goes all the way down to a 4-to-1 ratio. Can you imagine making a quarter wave ground plane on, say, 40 meters, where the radiator would be 32 feet long, and you make the radiator 8 feet in diameter? That would be a 4-to-1 ratio. Well, they did this at 1,000 megacycles. But the nice thing about antennas, everything scales. Take whatever mechanical antenna you've got. Take a picture of it. Either expand or contract the picture when you print it, and your antenna will be on a new frequency. Expand the picture and the antenna is on a lower frequency. You're really expanding the wavelength. Or compress the picture and the antenna is on a higher wavelength. If you change every single dimension of an antenna system, you will scale it in direct proportional to frequency, and the performance will be identical, as long as you have the same, approximately same conductivity of materials and the same dielectric constant of the insulators. Let me drop one more time. So the resistive charge goes everything from a 1,000-to-1 ratio down to 4-to-1. The reactance chart on the next page goes everything from, I think it's 2,000-to-1 down to something like 5-to-1. But that chart is not a mathematical derivation. I think it was done at Harold Wheeler's laboratory. That represents thousands of man hours of real measurement. Somebody at something like 1,000 megacycles or 500 megacycles, wherever his instrumentation was, made a whole slew of ground planes. He started off with a great big sheet of copper. In the middle of it, he built the actual radiator with a connector there. And it was done way back in the days when we didn't have modern network analyzers. He probably had nothing but a slotted line, a slide rule, and a hell of a lot of scraps of paper to do all these calculations. He went to all of those frequencies, all of those lengths, all of those diameters, measured all of those resistances, and measured all of those reactances. That is real data. Based on bedrock, if you know what I mean. Virgin shale bedrock, as I sometimes put it. As innocent looking as those curves have looked to you at first, in the last 5 years, the total number of dollars I have earned by using those exact curves, the total number of patents I have written, and today I'm writing another one that uses those curves. If you understand those curves and what they're saying to you, and if you look deep enough and you find their hidden meaning on antenna design, that is a database that is a mind blower. That's a strongly felt emotional opinion. KQKEY, KQLIW.
Definitely, this is KQKEY, yes, but Dick was just saying basically. I have used it extensively also. For instance, in determining feed point peaks, and I think we covered on the SIF chart quite a bit about this. We went from, like, 0 to 120 degrees in electrical range, and we were able to show the reactances and the radiation resistance right by using this method. Also, if you look at the chart, direct chart on radiation resistance, you'll see that like for vertical antennas we were talking about, they'll go from like 0 to approximately 60 degrees in electrical length. And then if you went ahead and they got the electrical length, for instance, the antenna, let's say, if you find that it's 30 degrees long, you will say, well, 360 divided by 30 would wind up at a 0.08 wavelength. I mean, this is what I was talking about, the electrically shorter vertical. And would have, if you looked at, you convert that, looked at on the chart, just look at my chart here, a quick chart here, you'll see that the approximate resistance falls to about 3 ohms. So that's why we use that type of method. So, like Dick says, a very handy method of basing it on a full wavelength of 360 degrees and cutting it up to use it for your particular function. Very straightforward, very simple, nothing mysterious about it. Anything else that I could add to this takeover?
Yep. You said 360 divided by 30. You meant 30 divided by 360. And that comes out, you have rounded it to 0.08, 0.0833, close enough. But if you want to see an example written out in handwriting, so to speak, typed out, on really using that chart, and the motivation for using that chart on that particular writing of mine was to take a dipole, and I don't care if the dipole is in free space, I don't care if it's 5 feet above the dirt in your backyard, I don't care if it's vertically polarized, horizontally polarized. I don't care if the dipole is part of a quarter reflector antenna, if it's part of your three-element Yagi, or your 30-element Yagi. Wherever that dipole is, if you want the impedance to be higher or lower to match your particular feed line, if you want the reactance to be more capacitive or more inductive, if you want the impedance to be perfect in order to give the highest possible performance on VHF and UHF frequencies for your low noise amplifier, you want to know how to adjust the lens diameter or whatever of your dipole or what variable capacitor to put across the dipole to make a perfect impedance match at your favorite frequency. If you are interested in that, and you should be, you go to the website of WA1MBA, www.WhiskeyAlpha1.net, I think it is. It might be .com, but it's .net. Anyhow, WA1MBA's website, which is an introduction to microwave enthusiasts. But you go to the bottom of his first page, and you'll find impedance matching of dipoles by K2RIW. You click on that, and you start reading the 1,500 words on the subject of how to get a perfect impedance match on any dipole you will ever build for the rest of your life. And you don't have to do anything elaborate, like suddenly flipping over from delta match to T-match or gamma match or whatever. Whatever your favorite method of matching is, doesn't matter. You simply adjust the length of the dipole until the resistive component goes to exactly 50.0 ohms, if that's what you want, or 72.0 ohms, if that's what you want, or 300.0 ohms, or 600.0 ohms, if that's what you want. You do nothing but adjust the length of the current dipole you are about to use, and you can do that by putting little pieces of copper tape on the end of the dipole, or putting sliding pieces of tubing out there. You adjust the length of the dipole until the resistive component gets to be exactly what you want. Let me drop. Then that chart will tell you exactly from that length, and that number of degrees of length, how much reactance is left over. And that, if you're smart enough, will tell you exactly what capacitor to hang across the feed point of the dipole in order to make the impedance match perfect. It is a process that has never been explained in any of the books I've ever seen. When I first published that article, the guys in England, the guys in Australia, and the guys in New Zealand jumped up and down with enthusiasm. Said it's about time. And they've republished it lots of times in their magazines. I tried getting it published in the United States, and the United States publishers say, that's a boring subject. Why should we publish that? And they didn't. You know, the closest I've come to publishing it is putting it on Tom Williams' website. But there it is. That's an extremely valuable piece of data, in my opinion. It's the most basic thing you need. There's a zillion different kinds of antennas you and I can hang on the end of that feed line that goes up your tower, or goes onto your chimney, or goes above the trees of your property, or whatever. There's a zillion kinds of antennas you can put there. A high percentage of them have some basic dipole or monopole-like thing to it. And the first thing you're going to have to make your feed line and your transmitter happy, the first requirement you're going to have is, how do I make the impedance right? You read that article, you read those two charts, and there it is. 90-some-odd percent of the time, that is the solution that we were looking for. It's a piece of knowledge we should all have to be respected ham radio operators that are real tinkerers. Again, a strongly felt emotional opinion. Back to you, Mel. K2RIW. Go right ahead. And I should know your name. Please tell me again.
It's Frank. K2RSO. Dick, you were talking about dipoles. We're using the next and use broadband antennas, and all of the OCFs be one of them. I have a question, but I don't know if it's too late. Maybe you prefer to save it for next week.
We're on the subject, Frank. I'm emotionally involved. Go right ahead with your question.
Okay, Dick. Probably all aware of the fact that there are companies out there that sell these antennas, and my belief is that price basically getting plates of wire, a balun, and some coax for less than the $200 since they're so easy to make. The basic one that's sold is a 135-inch length from end to end, and usually it comes with a configuration of side of the balun and 45 feet on the oven. Now, using this formula, is it possible, in other words, that using the basic premise that one leg is half the distance of the other leg, meaning the final antenna will have one-third on one side, two-thirds on the other side. Let's say instead of 90 and 45, we shorten it to 80 and 40, or 60 and 30. Will this type of OCF work as well as the long one, given the fact that we probably won't be able to hit 75 and 80 meters, maybe just 40 and 10, but will it still have the broadband effect and have the correct impedance to work properly?
Okay. You've used some good words there, Frank, and you've created a little bit of ambiguity. When you said the word broadband, the OCF, off-center fed dipoles you're talking about, I think in your particular case right now, the word broadband means it covers multiple bands. A properly designed offset fed dipole probably gives you rather good, acceptable performance somewhere in 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10 meters, or maybe a slightly smaller subset of that, but a number of bands, you're calling that broadband. And I agree with you, it is broadband from one point of view. From an engineering point of view, the word broadband means what is the true bandwidth within one of those bands. In other words, if I designed it for 3.7 megacycles, the middle of the 80 meter band, will it give me the performance I like all the way down at 3.5 and all the way up at 4.0? That's another definition of bandwidth. And the off-center fed dipole doesn't necessarily fit that criteria of bandwidth. Now, the off-center fed, 45 on one side, 90 on the other, just happens to be 2-to-1. That particular ratio happens to hit a number of ham bands simultaneously. And as long as you're willing to properly balance your transmission line, that's a rather nice antenna design. The charts that I'm talking about, these resistance charts and reactance charts, which I think was done by Harold Wheeler's laboratory, that's in those books I've mentioned, Antenna Engineering Handbook, and also the charts are there on the WA1MDA website. Those are monopole charts. The reason you can use them on a dipole is that a dipole is a pair of monopoles back-to-back. Well, it turns out an offsetter-fed dipole is also a pair of monopoles back-to-back. One monopole is longer to the right, one monopole is shorter to the left. So you can take the impedance of the right-hand side from the chart, resistive and reactive component, the resistance, by using the chart again, you can calculate the impedance for the left-hand side of your off-center fed dipole, and then calculate what's going to happen when you put the two in series. That's what back-to-back really means. They're being fed in series with the usual manner of feeding. So those charts will help you to predict exactly what's going to happen ahead of time. Your basic question was, if I go from 90-45 to 60-30, am I going to get a better solution for your particular definition of broadband? I think the answer is no, but you won't know for sure until you try using the chart. But the chart is giving the raw data by which you can. Bye-bye, you all.